In this Fiber Talk podcast with that embroidery girl, Georgina Bellamy, we learn about 3D gold work. The show is sponsored by Avlia Folk Embroidery at avliaembroidery.com. The parade of new designs continues from creative designer Krista West. New designs include the Rhodora Table Runner, and Krista has produced a mini floss tube video about that one, Clara's Garden, Mirabella Border, and Ukrainian Diamonds. Krista has received many requests for Ukrainian designs, and more are in the works. When you visit the Avlia website to explore the various designs, make it a point to visit the how-to section. In it, you'll find several videos that will help you on your stitching journey, including several that show how to finish your projects so you can display or use them. Also, visit the courtyard and join the rapidly growing community of Avlia Stitchers. Thanks to Avlia Folk Embroidery for sponsoring this week's show, and now, our conversation with that embroidery girl, Georgina Bellamy. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week is that embroidery girl, Georgina Bellamy. Georgina, welcome.
Hello.
Good to have you with us. All right. Now,
it's great to be here.
We're going to be talking about some gold work. We're going to be talking about some 3D stuff. But you start out at the London College of Fashion. Was that the I want to work in the world of haute couture?
Well, I actually started way back before that in a sort of a dry cleaners. It was really weird how the whole story evolved.
Dry cleaners. Okay.
Yeah. So I started off. I had my son fairly early in life, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I was working part-time in a dry cleaners, and there was an alterations man there who didn't speak much English. He was a Turkish guy. And so because he didn't speak a lot of English, I had to sort of get very involved with helping him with the customers and, you know, trying to get him to realise what the alterations were and stuff. And along the way of learning a little bit of Turkish, I also learned how to alter clothes. And so we would have scraps of fabric lying around, and I would take them home and try and make things. And they were often clothes for my son. And I once made a coat for my son, and I decided to do a little bit of embroidery at the time. I didn't know what embroidery was really. And just had a go, made a couple of like little, his favorite characters at the time. There was a program that he absolutely loved, and we took it out, and people would always stop him because he was a very attractive little boy, if I do say so myself, and they would say, oh, wow, where did you get that jacket from? And I started to think, well, you know, I don't want to be working in the dry cleaners forever. Maybe I could make some clothes. So that's kind of what kicked it off. I went to adult education college here in London to study clothes making. And on the side, I just happened to study embroidery. And a lady that was one of the external examiners for the courses I was taking happened to be very high up. Her name was Anthea Godfrey. She was very high up in the Embroiderers Guild here in England. And she didn't know me, but she saw the work and she said, you know, who is this girl? Because I'd done the clothes making course, but I'd covered everything in embroidery because I just really started to like embroidery. And I met her and she said, you know, you should think about going to university. And she happened to be one of the heads at the time at London College of Fashion. So she said, you know, I'll write you a statement, help you get in. And so that's what I did. I started off doing a foundation course in hand embroidery, but it wasn't hand embroidery. It was more machine embroidery. But because I had my son, I wasn't able to stay at college to university because it was up in West London. I was in the south of London. So you're talking about 3 hours really to get there, maybe sometimes 3 hours back in rush hour traffic. So I had to find a way to be able to complete the course basically at uni. So everything I had done was done by hand. It was done in the commuting journey to and from university because obviously I had my son. So it wasn't meant to be hand embroidery or haute couture. That really would have been Central St. Martin's, but it just ended up being that way, really. And that's kind of how the 3D stuff come about as well, really, because the just the logistics of sewing by hand, you can't really have a hoop. So if we're talking about so the course that I've done was obviously hand embroidery, hand embellishment. And so when you're thinking about embellishing a sheet of clothing, most of the time you're talking about fabric that's in a pattern piece, aren't you? And you would embroider it before it's made up. And so for that, if you're working by hand, you're usually working in big slate frames. You might be doing tambour beading or even hand beading, but you're working in these giant frames to keep that fabric taut, because obviously once you take it out of the frame, it's going to sort of like, you know, be quite gathered and not usable if it's not kept nice and flat. So that was one of the initial problems that I had, because I couldn't do the machine embroidery. I had to do stuff by hand, but I couldn't have big slate frames taking that on the tube because that wasn't going to work. I started
No, they would have been very upset. I could have seen you carrying your slate frame trying to, no, that would not
I would have been able to set it up. I would have needed trestles, all of that kind of stuff. So I really started
I would
to develop.
So pay to see that.
Oh, gosh, yeah, well, especially in London, because people don't have a problem telling you what they think. So, yeah, I just developed a way of – I started to develop ways of making my work 3D. And when you work in 3D, you don't need a hoop. You don't need a slate frame. You don't need trestles. And that's kind of just how it started, really.
Necessity, once again. Yep.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Did you originally intend to work in fashion and make clothes?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. That was a burning desire for me for a very, very long time. And I did. I worked in a studio in London. So I worked in a studio in London. And what would happen is that you'd probably meet the designer, or sometimes you'd get a brief come in and they'd say, you know, we want this, we want that, we want this. But because you're hand working and you're working by hand, you would often find, well, I often found that I was working by hand, but not actually getting, I would say, paid what I needed to be paid to survive, basically, because once you've paid out for your fare and once you've paid out for like your lunch in London, which is ridiculous, and you know, then you've got paid, you might have got paid, but you haven't actually got paid for all the work you've done, because this is hand embroidery. So part of it you're doing it for the love of it, and then part of it you're doing it because I actually need to eat. So it just wasn't very viable. It sounded amazing, but the reality for me and what I found was it was extremely hard to make a living working in a studio underneath a designer when you worked by hand. Perhaps that was indeed different for the machine artists that I saw, because they could make a particular, you know, piece, and they would be able to churn out quite a few of them. And you just can't do that when you're working by hand. You know, what you're making is a one-off and it might take you a week. You know, and there's very few people that can afford that embroidery once it's completely finished. So, and that's not coming about all the time as well. So, yeah, I found that route quite difficult to make viable.
So where did you go from there? Did you obviously didn't stay in?
Well, yeah. So what was happening? I come out of university and I was really lucky. I'd got this job at this studio and I was the only one that did out of my whole graduation class. And I felt, yeah, it really bolstered me. I felt really amazing, which is probably why I kind of lied to myself and stayed in the job for so long. And it was just one day, I remember, I just didn't genuinely have any money and I was working. And I was like, gosh, I don't have any money and I'm working. And so I quit and I was really scared because I thought, oh, what am I going to do? Because I've just quit this job. It's probably not the best thing I've ever done. And so what happened is I was really lucky at that time. The same lady that had been the external examiner, as I said, she was quite important in the Embroiderers Guild. The Embroiderers Guild were having a show in the Knit and Stitch show. So it's quite big here, a big textile show. And they have something called the graduate showcase. So when you graduate out of university, if you are good enough, if you're lucky enough to get picked, they take your work and they want to exhibit it at the Knit and Stitch show, which is a pretty big show. And I had all my fashion stuff there, but I'd also, because I get when I get bored, I also do embroidery. So I do embroidery for work, but also find that I do embroidery when I get bored if I'm not sort of working out. And I had this like little 3D lizard, and there was a French lady that walked past my stall, and she looked at this lizard and she kept looking at it. And I said, "Are you okay? You know, hello, are you okay?" And she was like, "I really like this." And I was like, "That's nice." And she said, I have a shop in Strasbourg. And I said, "Okay, you know." And she said, "Would you come and teach this in Strasbourg?" And I was like, "Okay." And in the show, it's kind of like, because I've done the show quite a few times, I've done many shows now, you kind of get opportunities, but often after the show, they don't follow through. You know, people say things and then they forget, or they lose your business card or whatever. So I thought, oh, she's going to forget that completely. And, at this time as well, I remember back then I was thinking, oh, I could go to Strasbourg. I don't even know really where Strasbourg is, and I haven't got any money either, so how am I going to go to Strasbourg? And she emailed me the next day, and she said, here's the proposal, and would you come? I thought, oh my gosh, this time obviously I didn't have my newborn, and my son was fairly, I mean, he was about, I'd say, 6 or 7, so it was easy to leave with other people. And I thought, okay. I said, well, I've got nothing else going on. I've just given up this job. I don't speak French, but, let's do it. And I didn't have any money. So I booked a coach from London, Victoria to Strasbourg, which was, I think it was a 20-hour, 45-minute coach journey.
Oh, my word.
Oh, yeah. And I know it was a lot. And and I made it to Strasbourg. I can't speak French now, but I understand a little bit. But back then I didn't even know where I was going. And the lady had offered me accommodation. I ended up making some really great friends in France. But at the time, I didn't know where I was going. I was just about managed to find this lady's house. And what I'd stumbled upon was in Strasbourg, they have a show called Talents. And it was basically a similar but smaller version of the Knit and Stitch show. And these ladies also had like embroidery guilds, little embroidery circles of ladies that enjoyed doing embroidery, and you could teach them. And that's basically what happened. I ended up teaching in France. I mean, I would say I always had to have an interpreter with me, even now I still do. And yeah, that was the first time that I really taught 3D embroidery. So that's where the teaching began, was in France.
Well, wow. And I can't imagine that, like, all of a sudden, because now you have, not only have you get there, but you've got to have kids and in some sort of instructions.
Yeah. I mean, let's just say that a lot of the French language that I understand is swearing. Because that's just all I heard. At first, because I've done a lot of teaching now with French people, and for the first 3 times I taught with French people, I was hearing so many French swear words, and I was thinking, I didn't know what it was. I'm not sure they're really enjoying this. They must be really enjoying this. Swearing at me in French. But I mean, because 3D embroidery, obviously, when you're working in 3D, it's already a jump out of what most people who like embroidery are used to doing, because there's traditions in, I've found, there's traditions in all countries. England has a particular tradition with embroidery, and France does too. And I've found a lot of French embroidery tends to sort of revolve around tambour beading and a lot of flat work, a lot of couture work, a lot of bead work, and especially with the tambour hook. So working 3D was quite new to the ladies that I had experience with. Perhaps in certain circles they're doing stump work, but that wasn't the experience that I've ever had when I've gone over to France. They're not really big in 3D work in the way that perhaps England has, quite a lot of stump work artists, and I would say it's quite prevalent-ish in England, stump work, whereas I felt like in France it really wasn't. It was much more much more tambour work, bead work, and some thread work, really beautiful, some gold work, but even the gold work has a very distinctive style, and it's usually flat or it's over card. It's a very particular style of work, French work. So yeah, so it was a little bit difficult, I think, especially the first time, for me to fully explain how you're going to turn bits of flat cloth and this gold work that they haven't really ever seen before, because the group of ladies that I was teaching gold work also wasn't something that they'd done before. Yeah, how are you going to turn that into a lizard? So, yeah, there was a lot of swearing. There was quite a few aliens that were made. They weren't lizards. They were definitely aliens. But we all had great fun. So, you know. Great fun after the swearing. After the swearing, it was good once we got to the end. They right, loved well, me.
After we get done recording, you're going to have to teach us to swear in French then. Okay.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Might be a good weapon to have. Yeah.
Yeah. Always need it.
All right. So, this fascinating, because you have no money. It's 20 hours away. And like Beth said, you got to put kits together. And Did you have the lady at the shop do that for you? Or how do you get this off the ground? You got your absolutely nothing to start with.
Mm-hmm. So at that particular time, the technique was very early in its conception. So I was using pretty much anything I could lay my hands on, really. I'd been really lucky and had quite a few things given to me from university, because I was the only person in my year, and for a long time, I think, at the London College of Fashion that had done a solely by hand sort of portfolio of work. And I'd been doing that from year one all the way through to year three when I graduated. So a lot of people knew that I was doing hand embroidery. So the lady that was the head of the department there was called Polly Kenny, and she had actually worked for Hand and Lock, which is a big gold work company here in the UK, in London. And she happened to have, that was the first introduction I even had into gold work, was Polly bringing me into her office and showing me gold work. And I'd got given quite a lot of stuff just because I was the only one that could use it. I mean, even now in my drawer, I must have about £4,000 worth of Swarovski crystals. I just got given them because no one else was using them. No one else was sewing by hand, you know. So, I just used to get things, and it was really out of my stash, I would say, things that people had given me, things that I might have bought here and there. And I knew I only had to make, I think at that time I made about 30, 35 kits, just in case I had any extra students. So it really started off very small. I didn't fully, because I was much younger and I had no experience really in business, I didn't conceptualize how I was going to turn this into a business, how this was viable or anything like that. I just went with sort of 35 kits. I remember 35 kits, a few bits and pieces here and there that was like stashed away, like of my stash, really, so that if someone had run out of something, I could back that up and, you know, here you go, here's some of that. And that was kind of it. And I learned a hell of a lot. Just from that experience.
Yeah.
It taught me a lot. Mm.
I can imagine. Yeah. Beth, we have just found a person with a bigger stash than you. I'm noting this.
All right. Well, not only of those crystals, only of the crystals. Okay. I don't have quite that many crystals. I do have a few, but not that many.
It's ridiculous. The stash in my flat is absolutely ridiculous. I think I have about 100. Now I have about 100 kilos of pearl in one of the cupboards. It's a big cupboard. It's in my kitchen. It's meant to be a larder, but it's not a larder. It's actually it's actually a gold work. I've got them all in sweet jars. You know, the old fashioned sweet jars. I think I've got 100, at least 100 sweet jars in, all stacked up in the larder, of all different colors of pearl and all different things related to gold work. Yeah. Yeah. Really pretty, because it goes all the way from the rainbow. It's all colors.
You can't find any food in Gina's kitchen, but you can stitch your brains out.
Absolutely. You're skinny and talented. That's what we're going for. Skinny and talented.
Oh, man. All right. Take let's back up a little bit. Take us back to your developing this 3D gold work. What do you call it? Sculptural gold work.
Yeah.
Take us through that process to the point where you can actually make standalone animals, because they're impressive. They really are.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's still a technique that that's developing now. I mean, like I said, so I was in a bind because at university, one of the teachers was quite against hand embroidery because obviously their perception of the craft was quite slow. And so I was really had to fight my corner to say, this is what I want to do and this is how I want to do it. Because, you know, at university where I went, we have the CAD machines, we have the Irish machines, we have all kinds of different old Singer machines that do embroidery. And that was really the way that they wanted to push you into, you know, expressing your embroidery. And so I had to fight and I had to find a way of making it viable. And I knew I couldn't go down the, you know, traditional lassage type of route, which was, I think, one of the problems that they foresaw, because whenever you spoke about embroidery and fashion and you spoke about hook couture and you spoke about hand embroidery, it would always be associated with lassage or with an embroidery company that were working with Tamba. And that's kind of what you think of, right? You think of like the Beyonce dresses or the Kim Kardashian when it's all covered in beads and all of that cat like Tamba work, which I knew there was no way I could do that because just time frames, it's taking me 3 hours to get here. I'm here for a few hours and it's taking me 3 hours to get back and I still have to be present for my son. So it was really about finding a way that I can work in my hands without the aid of a hoop. And so the first thing I was doing was really playing with bunching up fabric and creating like a solid base. So even though at the beginning of university, it wasn't really starting fully 3D, what I was often working on bases of leather, I'd love to work on leather because I didn't need a hoop. I would often work with things like beetle wings, which were traditional in gold work. I didn't know at the time, but things like beetle wings, I've got a great example of a beetle wing dress in the Victoria and Albert Museum that Queen Victoria actually wore. It was very traditional. It's not sort of a crazy, wacky idea. These beetle wings, scarab wings are quite traditional historically in embroidery. But things like that, that held their shape and you could work around them with your hands. Building on top of, you know, several layers of leather and what effect does that have, or using leather as sequins or anything that wasn't too delicate, that wasn't going to be crushed in my hands. And even when you know, one of my tutors was talking about tulle and, you know, it's haute couture and you're doing hand embroidery, you should work with tulle, and I didn't really get along with tulle terribly well in terms of hand embroidery on it, but I started to develop some of the 3D techniques by bunching the soft tulle, silk tulle, into balls and then embroidering over that. And what does that look like? And then I think in about year two, I made my first goldwork head. It was like the Scream, you know, the painting, the mask, the Scream mask. And it was like just a little, it was only little, it was about the size of my palm. And it was like a 3D... semi-3D head, because I'd already studied stump work. So if we go back to when I was doing all that embroidery at college, before I went to university, I was studying. I used to take my son, he was really small at the time, and we had a great adult education centre, and I was studying cloth making, but I was also studying stump work. I studied machine embroidery, I studied hand embroidery, I studied quilting. I'd done all of those for like a year. They were like year courses. And I literally dedicated about 2 years of my life to doing all of those. And they were City and Guilds levels 2s to 3s. So I had a good base technical knowledge of all of these embroidery techniques. And because I'd gone to an adult education in the UK, I was quite young at the time. You had the option to go to a college that was with people your own age, or go to adult education, which was a college where everyone was a lot older. They're usually typically retirement age. And I chose to go with the adult education. And it was a really good idea that I did, because a lot of the ladies from that particular era of learning, their understanding of textiles was a lot broader. So I was in the class with a lot of ladies that knew how to do lace work, tatting, I mean, you name it, they knew how to do it. They were doing quilting, and it was, you know, you wouldn't find that breadth of knowledge in people my own age at the time. So that was really where I learned a lot of my technical skills, was just engaging with people that were a few generations older than me, where they had experienced, I don't know, the 70s or the 60s. They were making their own clothes, they were doing their own crochet, they were doing their own knitting, they were, you know, they were doing lace making, they were doing bobbin lace, you know. So yeah, that gave me a great foundation. So I already had a lot of techniques to pull from when it come to working in 3D, because I already knew stump work. The only thing that I didn't really know too much about was gold work. And obviously Polly had shown me that, and who better, someone that had worked previously at Hand and Lock. I mean, people pay thousands of pounds for that, and I was just getting it for free. So by that point in time, I'd had so much knowledge from other people that knew embroidery, that it kind of wasn't that much of a leap, if you know what I mean, to sort of start working in 3D. It was, in fact, quite obvious to me that that was the only way that I was going to be doing it. So yeah. A lot of my work when I was working in university was really focused around like shoulders and around the neckline, because that was where I could put the weight of 3D embroidery. I think I've rambled. Sorry.
No, it's so fascinating because you have such a mixture of formal education and learning just from regular folk, and then your own determination to just develop your skills. It's a fascinating mix that gets you to the point where you can make these 3D things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, like I said, I've been really, really lucky because I've come into contact with, and I was always interested in, even when I go to France and stuff, you know, there's that cross-culturally, there's so many different ways to do embroidery. You know, the French do, so you think that you know everything about gold work, but then you go to France and they're doing, you know, French knotted pearls, you know, so the pearl metal in French knots, and you're like, oh my god, I've never seen that done in England, you know. Or you look over to Spain or Russia and they've got, I mean, I haven't been there personally, but I like to study their embroidery, particularly their 3D goldwork stuff, and you've got a different interpretation of a technique that we would use here in England. And it kind of shows you the differences in culture, differences in the way that people use these materials, and it gives you inspiration. So for me, it's a mixture of people that I've known, techniques that I've learned, things that I've made up in my own head, and things that people have been doing for centuries. I mean, gold work is obviously thousands of years old. I believe it's at least a millennia old. And 3D gold work in England, I mean, there's examples going back at least 500 years. So that nothing's kind of new. I suppose it's just the interpretation. And because I hadn't quite studied 3D gold work before I sort of made it up in quotation marks, I kind of felt like I'd made something up. But actually, when you go back in history, there's loads of examples, and they're absolutely amazing, like, you know, of 3D goldwork done in a little bit different. They tend to focus on carpet felts, which I've tried and I really don't like it. It's much less detailed. You can't get the level of detail that I have experienced personally. But yeah, I mean, yeah, just, yeah.
Yeah, but also it's having a mind that's open and yeah, willingness to learn and take in these things and then process them and develop your own style. I mean, you know, it's almost as if you're selling yourself short here a little bit. I mean, there really is a willingness to do that what if question and give it a shot and see Absolutely. What happens.
Well, I think that really come about in university because so that I remember actually when that feeling come about, because I used to be quite precious with my work, quite like, oh, don't touch, you know, this has taken me so long. And actually what happened, I remember that in year two, I had a particular teacher who was a design tutor, and he really didn't like the hand embroidery. He liked very contemporary embroidery and very much felt like my stuff, I remember him saying, it belongs in a museum, it doesn't belong on fashion. And I remember thinking, oh. And after that, I kind of just I kind of let it go. I remember being quite upset and sort of throwing some embroidery, sort of, you know, just throwing it. And after that, I really decided that I was going to do hand embroidery, but I wasn't going to be so precious. I was going to do whatever. So I would spray paint my embroidery. I would spend hours doing embroidery only to, you know, rip it up or cut it about. And that really helped me evolve the 3D work, because even now, if I'm not happy with something, let's say I've recently just done a dragon. Now that dragon's taken me a month, and I've got videos on my phone of countless mistakes that I've made along the way, and you might have invested a week into that mistake. And it's the ability to be able to admit that that's a mistake, chop it off and start all over again, that is actually, I think, in many ways, my saving grace, because I'm not precious about it. So I can be objective enough to say that looks terrible, but let's redo it. And it doesn't matter if it's taken me a week. It doesn't matter if it's taken me a month. We're going to do it again, you know. So, yeah, I suppose it is. I don't know. It's processing. It's more, you know, just constantly making mistakes. And every single mistake I see, it's just making me better at what I do, really. I prefer mistakes to the good things, if I'm honest. Yeah.
But it also sounds like you really had to fight through the schooling to get what you wanted out of the school, rather than to just follow the path of least resistance and make clothes.
Yeah. I mean, I think anyone that does embroidery, particularly if you studied it at degree level, or even if you haven't, you know, even if you're just someone that's doing this on Instagram and you're trying to get those followers, it is a fight. There's no, everyone has to fight, you know, and I really do feel that. It's always a fight. It's a fight because someone's nicked your ideas. It's a fight because someone nicked your video. It's a fight because someone has, you know, yeah, I mean, I've had experiences before where people took my videos and they're selling them as a class. I mean, so every step is a fight. So I have had to fight, but I think embroidery in general, especially if you want to be successful, I'd say the whole thing is a fight. That's what it feels like to me all the time. The fight kind of doesn't stop. It hasn't really at all. Yeah. But yeah.
Yeah, the failure thing, willingness to just say, nope, not working, get rid of it, try again, is that's tough for a lot of people to do. A lot of people just give up all the way around, but to be objective enough to say, nope, this isn't working.
Well, I mean, I think as well with embroidery, I don't know if any of your listeners will agree, but vast majority of the time embroidery goes through an ugly phase. You know, we go through, this is great, I'm enjoying doing this, to this looks like absolute crap and I want to throw it away. And if you push through the absolute crap bit and see it through, 9 times out of 10 in my experience, it really looks good at the end. It's very rare that you're kind of like, no, that is really, really terrible and I need to cut that off, or I need to do, you know. So to me, I don't think I can think of even one embroidery that hasn't had that feeling of this looks terrible right now. Yeah, but you just push through that, and yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Was there a point where you realized that you could make a career out of this thing and with enough money to live off of? Was there a juncture where you said, I'm going for it, or did it just evolve and next thing you know,
it was probably when I come back from France. When I come back from France, that was the first time that I thought, oh, okay. Because before that, I thought that my future had laid. So we'll go back to that day when the French lady Catherine saw my 3D lizard. That Georgina, the person that stood there before Catherine walked past, thought that her future lay in haute couture fashion. And somehow I had to, it's funny actually, somehow in the back of my head, I was thinking, I have to learn French because I need to go and work for Lesage. That was what I was thinking. I somehow need to convince Lesage that I am the next big thing and they need to hire me. And actually, you know, once she walked past, it was kind of like, oh, okay, that that isn't my future and that isn't actually viable. And even if you did work for Lesage, you might actually find that you don't have as much money as you would like, or you was as happy as you would like to be, because money's, you know, money's just money, but happiness is truly important as well. And it was really when I come back from France, because that experience of teaching, I'd never taught before, so I didn't know that I actually enjoyed it. I enjoyed showing people how to do things and bringing them pleasure and actually empowering them, because how I work as a teacher, it's moldable, right? What I do is very moldable. It's very, everyone, because it's mainly about hand pressure, particularly when you're working 3D in stump work or something like that. So everyone can have a slightly different look or a very different look. Like I said, some people made lizards. Some people did genuinely make aliens because the hand pressure was off and it just kind of looks crazy, right? But the empowerment that everyone felt, all of those people when they've gone through that, you know, this looks terrible, and then you slowly say, no, it doesn't. Come on, let's do this. Let's try this. No, I know. Let me just put a stitch here and it's going to change, and that's going to become a nose. I promise you, it's not going to look exactly like an alien right now. Okay, it does look like an alien, but this is the best gold work alien ever. Like, what are you talking about? All of those, I found, I really enjoy this. I love being around people, and I didn't know that. I love showing people this. And I realized that once I'd come back from France, that I felt like I had enough passion for it to make it viable, because the passion for the fashion was waning very hard, because you're not making enough money. And then when you do come up with a genuinely good idea, and this is, wow, Georgina, you've made this amazing, whatever it is, actually now it belongs to this designer and your name never appears. And that always felt like, oh, that always felt wrong as well. Like, oh, that's tough. And I know that's kind of, I suppose, quite egotistical, or I don't know. But it is important sometimes when you spend a long time with your embroidery, you know, it becomes almost like you're giving birth in a way. I know that's a weird analogy, but you spend a long time, you're drawing, then you're stitching. You might be stitching for hours, weeks. It becomes something more than just the embroidery, right? It becomes your vision that you've seen from a piece of paper, a sketch that you've done, a doodle, all the way through to its complete conception. And all of a sudden now it's got someone else's name on it. It's kind of like, oh, okay, that's not great. And I think when I come back from France, I just felt like, okay, I can make this work, and I can empower people. I can enjoy this, and I can also get known for what it is that I love. And I guess at that time, I needed that recognition. It was important to me, particularly at that time, most definitely. Yeah. I think because I'd had so many knockbacks, or so much like, it's not going to work. This looks like it needs to be in a museum. I don't like it. You know, because university is quite tough. Well, fashion university is very tough anyway. So yeah, definitely needed that validation at that time. Absolutely. Well,
And I can understand why, you know, if you've done all this work on a piece, mm-hmm. and then your name never appears with it, how discouraging that would be, because we all have this need to be recognized, and just some sort of that saying, okay, this is great, you know, that would be very, very discouraging. I could imagine that would be just...
Yeah, I found it. I mean, I think now I'm a little bit older, I'd probably be absolutely fine with it. But particularly back then, I was much younger, and I really did feel a need for validation, and that I wanted that spotlight of, this is me and this is my work. I felt that we weren't, I know it sounds really weird, we weren't separate, almost like my work was me, you know, my art was me, and to give it to someone else, or to not have people know what I was doing or what I was capable of, was, I don't know, at that time it was really tough. I really wanted the world to know that this is what I do, and this is my embroidery, not anyone else's.
Well, yeah. Don't you feel like sometimes, you know, when we do, we spend a lot of time in doing embroidery, a part of ourself goes into it, you know, no matter if it's a simple cross stitch project you're hanging on the wall. You know, if someone took that and said, well, I stitched that, I would be like, wait a second.
Absolutely. You know? I mean, I've had students. I mean, it's so funny because we obviously most people that are going to listen to this are embroidery people, so or embroidery people or textile people. So we understand each other. And I always remember I've had several students and they've made something like they might have made a box. I remember one specific lady made a box. So box making, this is not, you know, this is not easy. This is technical skill. She's covered her box in embroidery. So you've made a box and then you've embroidered your box. And this has taken many months. And she's put her handmade chocolates in the box and she's given it away to her friend as a gift. And the next time she's seen her friend, she's asking about it. And then she said, "What did you do with the box?" And the friend looked at her and said, "Well, I just chucked it away."
Oh,
no.
And it is kind of that, you know, you didn't appreciate the, you know, everything that had gone into that box. That was, but only embroidery people know that, right? She felt like you'd thrown away a little bit of her soul.
Yeah.
Because yes. To her, an embroidery person, you've taken something that she's made, and this other woman's just looked at this box and gone, "Oh, that's nice, but you know, it's finished now. I don't need it anymore. Chuck it away." You know, it's your perception on everything, isn't it, as well? And but I definitely felt like I still do feel like it, but as I've got older, because I've done so much embroidery, I'm a lot less precious about my work. But yeah. Definitely at that time it was my soul, and I felt like I was giving my soul to other people, and my name wasn't anywhere, and I wasn't getting paid right, and it was just, you know, it was just a lot. And when I come back from France, that was really like, okay, this might be how I can do it. This might be way forward.
All right, tell the story of the Jewel of the Sea in the Passion for Needlework, the Blackest and Creamer ebook. I hauled my copy out and actually showed it to my wife and watched her jaw drop too. How did that come about? I mean, because that little turtle is beautiful.
It is.
Yeah. So what happened was I used to have a Sunday class I was teaching every week. And one of the weeks I decided to go to the Victoria and Albert Museum with the students. And I'd been asked to do something for the book and I didn't know what the hell I was going to do. And it was actually... Even remembering it now is making me sweat a little bit because the deadline was coming nearer and nearer and I still hadn't done anything because I didn't know what to do because they wanted something 3D. I knew that because of how I work, really ideally, I'd have to be there to show you how to do this because, you know, it's only a segment in a book. It's not my book. So I'm not explaining techniques. I'm not explaining principles of, you know, all this hand pressure, needle direction, even the needles that you're using, the thread that you're using, are you doubling it or are you singling it, you know, how many layers, all of this kind of stuff. So, oh, it was really stressful. And I remember at one point thinking, I think I'm going to just have to tell them that I can't do this. And I went to the Victoria and Albert Museum with the students and we were walking through, they had a Beatrix Potter exhibition on at the time. And we walked through that aisle into where they had all this jewellery. They had all different types of jewellery from all different eras. So they had a lot of Art Deco from the 1930s, 1920s. And I saw a little turtle with a, I think it was a lapis lazuli, like a blue stone on its back. And I looked at that little turtle and I thought, oh, okay. And that was it. That was really where it come from, was in my mind. As soon as I saw that piece of jewellery, I was like, okay, that's two pieces of gold work stacked onto each other. One of them's semi-flat and one of them's a dome shape. I know how to do both of those shapes. Let's go. And that's literally how it happened. It was seeing that piece of jewellery, which is, I mean, I can't believe I didn't think to do that previous to it, because not the turtle, but look at jewellery, because I often look at jewellery for inspiration. But I think it was just the stress of knowing that it was going to be for this. It was going to be a big deal in a book. And, you know, and obviously with 3D embroidery, you're never completely sure, because it can be hit, it can be missed. So, for example, the turtle, huge hit. I done another project with them the last time, which was a penguin, a lot harder to execute, and it hasn't been a big hit. And it's kind of knowing that, and it's a learning curve for me as well, because it is really a difficult discipline, 3D, especially completely 3D, for people to understand and to be able to get that across in just essentially pictures and text is extremely difficult.
No, wait a second. I've got to interrupt you. I love that penguin.
Thank you, Beth. Thank you, because I was going to say the same thing. Wait a minute.
I've shown that to people, and they're like, okay, you need to do that, Beth. And I'm like, I think I can visualize doing the turtle. You're right. It seems like, okay, this is flat, but that, because if he'll topple over if you don't get him right.
Yeah, it's difficult. And this is one of the things I've always had about the technique in itself, was trying to make that technique viable outside of me teaching. Because obviously when I'm there and I'm present, I'm in front of you, I can explain to you how we're going to do this and how we're going to doctor it. And if you get it wrong, I can help you. But I think when you're trying to get that across in pictures and text, yeah, it's incredibly difficult to do. And I think perhaps a 3D, completely 3D, like that little bird, or, you know, like the penguin, or like, you know, I think about, I've done models of cats and dogs and stuff to try and teach them. And it's just like, do you know what, Georgina, this is going to be incredibly difficult, even though you know what you're doing, to write that down in a book and take photographs, and it's going to be very difficult for someone to follow. So that has been one of the major questions, I suppose, in all of this for a while, is like, the only way that this can grow bigger, a sculptural gold work, is if I do some kind of book. And lots of people ask me that, is there a book on this? Where do I learn how to do this? And I'm kind of like, there's not a book on this, and I don't know where you'd learn to do this. You can come with me and learn it, but I haven't written a book yet. And even if I did write a book, I'd have to give you really simple projects, which means you wouldn't be learning the full technique anyway, because the full technique kind of, it's a roundabout, it's constantly going around in a circle. So I've yet to solve that one, really. And I suppose now that I've got baby, because during the pandemic, a lot of things changed in my life, which meant that embroidery had to take a back seat. And now that my son Isaiah has come, he is kind of, I would say that he has allowed me to do some embroidery, but he actually hasn't, because he's turned into a huge whinge bag. But I still get to do more embroidery than I was doing before, which has been great, actually, because I've been making a little mouse now. So hopefully we'll be able to do some workshops very soon. And I'm sorry, I've forgotten what I was talking about.
So have you tried Zoom classes? I mean, that's the thing that has happened because of the pandemic, is a lot of people move to these online video
forums. I have done many videos and filmed classes and done videos like that. But they're always for simple things, so it'll be for bees or like some sort of bug, or even like a lizard. I've got a lizard video, I've got videos, but they're usually, so exactly like the turtle, sort of semi-flat. You're working, although it is 3D, you're working two shapes that are semi-flat, as opposed to a completely 3D shape. I think 3D is just very difficult to get unless you're in person, even on video, because you kind of need maybe two or three angles of the video, and you need them almost simultaneously to show how our eyes would see this. You know, because when you're filming, sometimes I think, gosh, there's a deficit here. I need to almost go and unpick that stitch and show you it from the other angle as well, because this is how it needs to look in a 360. Because when we're working 3D, we don't just think about the initial flat surface that you're seeing. It has to work all in conjunction with everything else, you know. And so you can't lay a stitch without thinking about where that stitch is coming out on the other side, because it all has an effect. So it's quite difficult to get it across in even video. But I'm sure things, I think, reveal themselves as time goes on. And so I'm pretty sure that at some point the way to do it is going to be revealed to me. I just haven't found it quite yet, because I'm quite determined. But I'm 37 now, so I think, well, it might be quite lazy of me, actually, but I do think I've kind of got time to, you know, write this all down and show people. And obviously, you know, someone might come up with their own way of doing this or whatever, but I've still got time to do my version. You know, I don't, the thing I don't want to do is rush. I mean, I've been knocked back from doing a book a few times now anyway from publishers, but I personally don't want to rush it anyway. I want to make sure that I know everything that I possibly can about the technique, because even as I go along, I learn from students. I, you know, I'll have students that will come in, they've never done gold work before. And, you know, I'm often humbled. I often start the class thinking, I know everything, I'm the teacher. And then someone goes, well, why didn't you do this? And I'm like, oh, yeah, no, that might have been, I'm just going to pretend that I knew about that, but I really didn't. You know, it's a humbling experience. Even when you think that you're an expert, you think, oh, I've been doing this for, you know, over a decade, I know everything. Actually, you find that when you're working with other people, especially students from other disciplines, being sort of humble and not thinking that you know everything has been really good for me. I try to always remember that. You don't know everything, Georgina. That's what I always say to myself. You don't know everything, so don't think you do. And whenever I say that to myself, I always end up learning something from someone else. Because, you know, it's difficult. When you're a teacher, people expect you to know everything, and you're meant to be an expert, and you're meant to know this and know this and know this. And so sometimes it can be difficult, I've found anyway, to step back and say, actually, I don't know this. Because sometimes in the eyes of students, you kind of lose that credibility when you admit that, you know, actually, I don't know. But when you're able to do that, that's when you learn, you know. So that's what I try to do anyway. I always try to say, okay, I'm good at this, but I don't know everything about this. So that's kind of where I want to be when I'm doing a book. I kind of want to be, not I know everything, but I know more than I do now about how to get this technique across to you, perhaps how to make the pattern easier for you. Or even perhaps I'll evolve, you know, mentally to the point where I'm like, okay, because right now I'm obsessed with detail. So, and I've been obsessed with detail for many years. And when you're working in fine detail, that's extremely difficult to get across to students who are new to a technique, because really block shapes are the best. So perhaps it is that I've developed a new way of coming across where I can make block shapes without a high level of detail, but still quite nice. I mean, the turtle was really the first one of that, because if I look at the next turtles that I ended up making, they're highly, highly detailed now, to the point where they've got, you know, second eyelid, not eyelids, but they've got different eye shapes, and I've gone really into the intricate details of making that turtle, whereas the one for Inspirations was very blocky shape and very blocky with the detail. It was very refined back. So I think that's still something that I need to learn how to do, really, is refining back the detail, because I get lost in that sometimes. Yeah. That's quite hard to translate over to students.
Yeah, I know what you mean about having students in a class, too. My second teaching job was teaching biology in a farm community. And, kids who live biology every day from the day they're born, yeah, they know a few things about it. And there was more than one instance where I said something or said I wasn't sure, and some farm kid raised their hand and explained in great detail how it worked. And yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
I'll take
it,
you back.
It can be very humbling experience, especially when you're a teacher. When someone does that, you can be like, oh, you're kind of, because you're meant to know, but at the same time, right, you've also learned something. So it's kind of like a win-win, but also you have to take your humility. It's a mixed feelings on that one.
Right. The first time it happened, that was my reaction, is, well, wait a minute, I'm the teacher, I know these things. And then I reflected on it later. And then the next time it happened, it was, all right, we're just going off on a tangent. You guys tell me about this. And it changes the whole dynamic, and it's worth it. Yeah.
It is worth it. It is worth it. Absolutely. Yeah. And you make more sort of, you do tend to sort of make more, say, friends, because you don't want to be, especially if you're teaching smaller children, friends as such, but you kind of come across more relatable. And I think it's nicer in general. That's been my experience.
Oh, yeah.
I know when I first started teaching, I felt like I had to know everything. And I used to sit with like history books, and so that as soon as someone questioned me on something, I felt like I could say, well, actually, at this period of time, and, you know, and I let up on that because I was just like, Georgina, you're doing too much. You need to relax. Like, it's okay to not know. It's okay to not know.
Yep. That's where the saying comes. If you want to learn something, go ahead and teach it. And yeah, you'll learn it. All right. We're going to run out of time here. So you're working on a mouse. What lies ahead for you now? So the baby's born. You're going through that phase now where you can't sleep. So you're getting a little embroidery time. What comes up? Is there more workshops, more projects? What lies ahead here? What can we look for?
Uh-huh. So this year is the retrospective exhibition for the Embroiderers Guild. So you go all the way back to the beginning of the story when I started out at the Graduate Showcase and the French lady Catherine walked past. This is the anniversary of that show, and that's where my latest dragon is going into. So that's going to be a retrospective exhibition. So that's one of the places where my work is going to be on display. I've always taught for the Knit and Stitch show anyway, so I'm always teaching at the venues and places like that. I teach across the country for the events. What are they called? Intermediate events, I think they're called. So I teach for them anyway. In regards to workshops, when the pandemic happened, because my mum got very sick with COVID, and I have an aunt that's very old. Unfortunately, there was no one to look after my aunt. So that really took a back seat. So it's going to depend right now on certain family things and if everything works out. So we might be looking at next year at some point, hopefully, if things all pan out and everyone's healthy and then baby's obviously a little bit older. And if not, it'll probably end up being online. And just when I have time, I've been questioning myself loads about bringing just baby into the embroidery content, because one of the things that's really struggled with my life changing around my aunt has been making content, because it's very difficult when you're caring for someone to get the time to do anything else. And now I'm not doing that so much. I'm obviously caring for baby, but people love babies. So I've often thought, could I show what a day in my life is like with a newborn trying to do embroidery? Is that something people want to see?
I don't know.
I've filmed it. I've done the videos, but I'm sort of scared for some reason to just like put it out there and go, okay, this is my new life. Because before on Instagram and stuff, it was very private. It was always about the work. It's never been about me. And that's kind of a vulnerable place, right? Showing yourself and your life. And so I'm not sure yet. There's something that stopped me from hitting that post button. So maybe I'll get brave. Maybe I'll get brave. I don't know. But yeah, that's kind of what needs to happen. There needs to be a regular stream of content coming out. So I think realistically, if that is what needs to happen, then maybe baby content mixed with embroidery content needs to take place, and I need to say, well, this is what it is now. This is the new chapter of that embroidery mum. This is that embroidery mummy.
Well, I'm sure there's many a young woman who could relate to trying to do embroidery with and raise a baby.
Yes, absolutely.
Raising a baby, just in general, it's definitely hard work. Not hard, I remember.
Yep.
Right. It takes a lot of time and an energy. There's no way around it.
Yep.
Absolutely. To do it right and to do it justice. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Must be present.
Yes.
And otherwise you're just going to miss it, you know, like, yeah, there's so much stuff that happens even day to day, especially when they're newborns, that, you know, you blink and you miss it. So I also don't want to lose that. I don't want to be so wrapped up in work. I'm like, I missed you saying your first word, or I missed you, you know, doing something.
Yeah. Mm. Yep. All right, Georgina, thanks. Wow, what a ride. Good for you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
No, it's that willingness to make it happen against all kinds of pressures from the outside that really is admirable. So, bravo. Yep.
Well, yeah, I'm under that now as well. A newborn, and I've got to somehow find a way to bring this all back. So, yes, it seems to be a theme for me in my life in general. So, yes, I'm sure I'll do it. Knowing me, I will do it.
Yep.
So, yeah.
All right. The website is That Embroidery Girl, soon to become That Embroidery Mom. No.
Yeah.
All right, Georgina, thanks so much. And thanks to everyone for listening.
All right. Bye.
Bye.